Before we begin this mitzvah podcast, I want to tell you that this is the last time that you will hear a fundraiser, an appeal, any mention of the Torch annual campaign in the year 2024. This is it. We do it once. We do it towards the beginning of the year. We ask everyone to come and chip in, to make a donation. Every donation is doubled. The website is givetorch.org, and you can find the link in the description. And you could choose to support the wonderful mitzvah podcast that we all love. And you're going to hear it now. And please God, you're not going to hear about it again until the year 2025. Could you believe it? The year 2025 is just around the corner, but now it's the year 2024. And we have a campaign and we're trying to raise money to support the great work of Torch, the Torch Center in Houston, Texas. And of course, the Mitzvah Podcast, and you could do that right now by clicking the link in the description, givetorch.org. Every donation is doubled. Support the Torch Center. Support the great work of the Mitzvah Podcast. Support spreading Torah and awareness of the Almighty and His Mitzvos in 2024. And of course, my email address is rabbiwolpe@gmail.com. We are up to mitzvah number 147, and although the mitzvahs that we've been covering recently have all been related to sacrifices, this one is not really related to sacrifices. This is the prohibition against the consumption of forbidden fats. There are parts of an animal that are known as chelev, fats, and there are fats that are permitted to be eaten and fats that are forbidden to be eaten, and this is the prohibition against the consumption of forbidden fats. And the way it actually fits into the narrative, it's talking about sacrifices. These parts of the animal are sacrificed on the altar. They are consumed by the altar, so to speak, but not by humans. And this is the prohibition, mitzvah number 147, to not consume the forbidden fats. Now, in general, this is an interesting law because we're dealing with kosher animals. So the animal's kosher. It's one of the animals that qualify. It has the split hooves, it chews its cud. But there are parts of it that are forbidden. So for example, this is actually the next mitzvah, mitzvah number 148. The blood of a cow. A cow's a kosher animal. But the blood of the cow is prohibited. We saw mitzvah number 3 way back in Genesis. The sciatic nerve. You remember the story. Jacob is having a nocturnal struggle with this angel, of Esav, and he strikes his hip and he dislocates it. And the verse tells us that that's why the descendants of Jacob may not eat from that part of the animal. Animals kosher in general, but there are parts of it that are prohibited. Of course, we have the milk and meat. The idea that meat is kosher, unless it's mixed with milk, then the kosher, otherwise kosher meat would be prohibited. Of course, if the animal's not sacrificed, you have a kosher animal, the cow, but you shoot it as opposed to slaughtering it in the proper way, that animal's not kosher. Or what if you do slaughter it in the proper way, but then in the post-mortem inspection, the animal is found to be sickly, that animal would be retroactively not kosher because a sick animal is not actually kosher. And here we have another example of this phenomenon, the forbidden fats. These are prohibited, and it's actually a very serious transgression. If someone willfully consumes the prohibited fats, the punishment for that is karis. It's a very serious, very harsh penalty. Now, in the literature, there are two words for fats. One's called chelev, which is the forbidden fats, and one's called shuman, which is the permitted fats. If we were to translate them into English, they're both fats, you know, the parts of the animal that are, you know, not meat, they're more fatty. One is a reference to the permissible fats and one to the prohibited ones. And the Ramban, in his commentary to Leviticus, tells us that the difference between forbidden fats and permitted fats is that when the fat is kind of marbled, it's intermingled with the meat, that is an example of shuman, of permitted fats. When it is separate, separate means you could remove it. It's like there's a surrounding membrane. You could remove it. It could be peeled off. That would be chelev. It is forbidden fats. Now, this is found in many places in the animal, primarily around the internal organs, so like the heart, the spleen, the stomach, the liver, or in the hind quarters of the animal. Now, there is a process of removing the forbidden fat. So you have an animal, it's a kosher animal, it was slaughtered properly, in the post-mortem inspection, it was found to be healthy. The animal's kosher, but there are parts of the animal that must be removed in order to have the meat that's surrounding those parts to be permitted. And there's a process called nikur, which is to know which fats are prohibited, and to remove it in a way that none of the prohibited, forbidden fats remain. Now, I had previously thought that this is a very hard job to do. In America, it's almost impossible to find parts of the hindquarters of an animal. So like sirloin, tenderloin, these kinds of steaks are very hard to find kosher, because what the kosher slaughterhouses simply do is they take the whole back part of the animal and just give it off to the non-kosher market. The process of nikur, it's just too complicated to do, and maybe we don't know how to do it properly, or maybe there are questions if it's done properly, and are there enough experts to do it? And therefore, they just simplify, take the whole back part of the animal, and that's not part of the kosher pile. We just have the front part of the animal. And then I thought, well, maybe it's hard to do, but it's also not economical. And I'm like, you know, I actually once saw a video of the process of nikur. I'm like, that looks kind of complicated. And it almost looks like it's, you know, surgery to remove certain parts. But it's to be a surgeon without the prestige and the paycheck, it's just not economical. And thus, as a practical matter, certainly in the kosher meat market in America, this process of nikur chelev, of removing of the chelev, removing of the forbidden fats, is just not practiced. Now, there are parts of nikur that are done. So like the liver, the aforementioned liver, you can find a lot of kosher beef liver here, because it's much simpler to do the nikur on that. But the hindquarters of the animals are just simply sold to the non-kosher market, and it's just very hard to find a sirloin steak in America. Now, in Israel, because the kosher market is so much bigger, it's just not feasible to sell it off to the non-kosher market, and therefore there, nikur is practiced. At least that's what I had thought. Now, as fate would have it, over the weekend, I see someone who's visiting the neighborhood for Shabbos, and I go over and I say, hi, how are things? Who are you? What's your story? He's visiting the community for Shabbos. And he's a butcher. He's involved with the kosher processing and, you know, one of the big distributors of kosher meat in America. So I said, okay, well, I'm doing some research about this nikur thing. Tell me about it. Why don't we have it? So he's all over it. And he says, actually, we should have it. And it's not that complicated. And there are all sorts of technologies and new tools that we have. And there's the ability to have transparency, to know that nikur was done properly. And it's done everywhere else. They do it in Israel. They do it in Mexico. They do it in Argentina. And actually, it is to the detriment of the kosher consumer to not have it done here, because it makes the kosher market less appealing to the slaughterhouses, because they're only selling parts and they're asking for this part, not that part. So it actually artificially raises the price of kosher beef. So he was very much in favor of actually changing the policy here. But he said it's very hard to change established policies and practices. And none of the kosher certifications want to go first and say, well, we'll do it now. As we know, people are very averse to altering policy. But then he said, well, if you actually need some of those states. Wink, wink. I know a guy. Maybe we have some of it available. It's definitely doable. But regardless, that this whole concept, this whole world of nikkur, of the removing of the fats, is only because of this mitzvah, that there are parts of a kosher animal that was slaughtered properly and was found to be kosher in the post-mortem inspection that are forbidden, and you must remove them, and that is, you know, a little bit more of a complicated process, and it's not actually done here, at least not on a large scale. But it is important to note that this art or this science of removing the forbidden fats, it's actually something which is very much needed, you know, when the temple's restored and the paschal offering is restored. As we know, we saw this just recently. Every single little bit of that meat must be consumed. There's a prohibition to have any leftover meat. Well, what about all the parts of the animal that are close to the chalav? Well, they must be eaten as well. But what do you do with the chalav? What do you do with all the forbidden fats? You must remove it. So nikkur is a process that we cannot forget how to do. And it would be a good idea for that knowledge to be more ubiquitous, because it is something which is definitely needed in the messianic times. Now, what's the reason for this mitzvah? We have an animal, it's a kosher animal, and it was slaughtered properly, and it was found to be healthy in the post-mortem inspection. Why is there this mitzvah, this prohibition against the consumption of these forbidden fats? And in general, the Sefer Chinuch ponders the question, you know, food is food is food, right? It's just energy, it's just fuel, just calories that you need. Isn't our focus the soul? Why would the Torah govern so much about what we eat, what's permitted, what's prohibited? What is the relation between physical food, food that nourishes the body, and the soul? So he tells us a principle that's applicable across all the laws of food, of what's allowed to be consumed and what's not allowed to be consumed. He tells us that the body is a vessel for the soul. And thus, the body is not just some commodity item, some commodity implement. It's holding the soul. Moreover, it is what effectuates the will of the soul. The body is the tool, the implement that exercises the will of the soul. And therefore, it's important to have a body that's going to be conducive to the agenda of the soul. And only to the degree of the body's purity and stability and spiritual equilibrium, only to that degree will the body be a good candidate to follow the counsel and the wisdom of the soul. And therefore, it's important for the body to be fed and to be nurtured in a way that's not going to cause it to deviate away from the agenda of the soul. It's got to be strong, it's got to be sound, it's got to be balanced. And thus, it's important to look at the inputs that go into the body. And then he adds an interesting point. He says, well, what were to happen to a body if the body was withheld from eating? Absent food, the body withers, it gets smaller, it gets weaker. And of course, when the body's fed, it gets nourished. And thus, if you were to kind of map out the body's relationship with food, with no food, the body gets smaller and gets weaker and starts to wither. And with food, it stays strong, it stays robust. So effectively, the body is rebuilt with food. This is the old saying, you are what you eat. Because your body is what you eat. That's how we would rephrase that. Your body is what you eat. Because if you don't eat that, then the body gets smaller. So thus, if you do eat it, the body is actually it's the product, it's the manifestation of what you ate. So the food is really the building blocks of the body, and thus good food will result in a robust and healthy body, and one that can be a good partner for the soul in its agenda. And therefore, the Almighty in his kindness says the Sefer Chinuch, he tells us what food to eat and what foods to avoid, because those will help the body be strong and sound and spiritually primed to do the will of the soul. And then he tells us this idea would apply to all the mitzvot that relate to food, what we can eat and what we cannot eat. And then he adds one more point. These fats, they cling to a person, they clog things up, they bring bad health outcomes, and that would be a good reason for us, a good rationale for us, a good justification that we can understand as to why the Torah prohibits these fats. Interesting. So he's kind of looking at this mitzvah on a very basic level that resonates with all of us. Well, you're supposed to be healthy. And the foods that the Torah bans, on some level, they're not healthy, not good for you on a physical level, on a spiritual level, and therefore the Torah prohibits them. You know, I saw a graph recently that was charting life expectancy on a graph of socioeconomic status. And it was doing it in various Israeli cities. And you see that it's highly correlated, that the higher the socioeconomic status, the longer people live. You know, health outcomes, longevity outcomes seem to be highly correlated with socioeconomic status. Except there are complete outliers. The very, very religious cities, meaning the cities in Israel that have a high population of very religious people, the correlation does not seem to apply. There is very low socioeconomic standards, I guess by the metrics that are used, and very high life expectancy. And I was trying to figure out, you know, why is there this outlier, this discrepancy, these people who don't seem to have the characteristic that would lend itself to a long life expectancy, yet they have it. Some speculated, well, maybe because they have large families and therefore, you know, great grandma, she has people to help take her to the doctor and to remind her to take her pills. Or maybe they live more fulfilling lives and therefore there's not as much depression or isolation or loneliness. None of the speculators said what I would think is maybe the strongest reason. Maybe these people who live their whole lives trying to say, how do I do what God wants me to do? Maybe he protects them. If you're committed to him, he'll make sure that you have a long life. We also know, the Talmud tells us this, that sins, they shrink the lifespan. So if someone is going to live a life, again, no one's perfect, but someone is going to live a life at least nominally where they declare, I want to avoid the sins that violate the will of Hashem, well, maybe the life is longer for that reason. And maybe there's some of this, that the Torah law is designed to promote bodily health as well as spiritual health. Our friend Mark sent me an article. It was a hypothesis. Why do religious Jews have a lower incident rate of heart disease? And they speculated, maybe, wrapping leather straps tightly around your arm for about a half hour a day, maybe that does wonders to cardiovascular health. Thank you, Hashem, for giving us this heart health benefits of wrapping tefillin. Is that why we have tefillin? It's very hard to make that argument, but maybe that's a little bonus along the side. So this is like a nice idea. And I'm a little bit wary taking it too far because there is a school of thought that said, well, all the laws are just designed to have good bodily health. And I think that's a misrepresentation of what the Chinuch is saying. And it's really a corruption of the whole notion of the Torah. The whole notion of the Torah is that we have a soul, and that's really the centerpiece of our identity. And that's what's going to live on beyond our lifetime over here. And that's what we're prioritizing. So the idea that all of Torah is just there to have, to promote a good physical and bodily life, to me, that's a corruption. But maybe there's like a side point, like a side benefit. That the Almighty creates everything, creates the physical world and the laws of physics, and creates our bodies and knows what's optimal for our bodies. And maybe there's going to be a side benefit of the mitzvos, that they will actually promote our health. And that is important, because after all, only once we're alive and the body's functional, only then can we do mitzvos and actually become closer to our Creator. And that's perhaps an idea that can apply to this mitzvah and to many others that relate to what we can and cannot eat. But there are other ideas featured in the literature. Many of the commentaries point out that this mitzvah, the forbidden fat, and the blood, which is the next mitzvah, in both of them we're told they must be placed upon the altar. They are offered to God, so to speak, and thus they're for God and not for us. Which is why, perhaps, this law does not apply to all animals. It only applies to kosher animals. But even with kosher animals, it's only the particular species of animals that are offered as sacrifices. Animals that are never offered as sacrifices don't have these laws. So maybe the reason behind these laws relate to the fact that these specific animals, and we'll see which animals they are, these specific animals are offered as sacrifices, and thus the parts that are exclusively for God, we should not eat from them. And along these lines, I saw something very interesting. The commentaries suggest that, you know, you think of fat as being something which is kind of stationary, and it connotes laziness and stasis. Whereas blood, it connotes like alacrity and speed and vitality and life. We're told that the blood and the fat is kind of placed upon the altar for God. We have impulses, we have characteristics, we have tendencies of being aggressive, of being using alacrity and speed and determination and ferocious desire. And we also have the tendency to be lazy and just let things happen. And both of them really could be used for good. And of course, the opposite is true as well. If there's a mitzvah, right? What are we supposed to do with a mitzvah? The word mitzvos can also be read as matzos. Just as a matzah, you don't want to tarry. You wait around too long, the matzah becomes chametz. Mitzvah is the same way. You have to do it right away. Eagerly jump at the opportunity. When it comes to a sin, in that instance, actually laziness is the preferred way to interface with it. Yisrael wants you to do a sin. One of the best tactics to resist that is to say, oh, I'll do it tomorrow. What's the rush? When Moshe appointed Joshua to go fight against Amalek, he said, oh, we'll do the war tomorrow. Why not right now? Amalek is representative of the Yetzer Hara. The way you fight, or one of the ways that you resist the Yetzer Hara, is by saying, we'll do it tomorrow. We'll engage tomorrow. And this is how you can use both the blood and the fat, so to speak, for God. Both the eagerness and the excitement and the immediacy of action that's represented by the blood, where there's this full force and there's never a break and it's pumping vitality to every part of you. Use that for God. When there's a mitzvah opportunity, jump on it. Seize it. And this laziness and this fat, and I'll sit on the couch, I'll get to it eventually. Use that for God as well. When it comes to doing a sin, I'll get to it eventually. And tomorrow won't be as exciting. Now, of course, there's the opposite. You know, almost like our default. Our default is the opposite. Is that we're eager to do the sin, and we jump on it, and we gotta do it right now, and the mitzvah will get around to it. So laziness on one hand, and speed of action on the other hand, if they are marshaled by the Yetzer Hara, we're toast, because we'll never get around to those mitzvos, and we'll just do all those sins. And perhaps this is why in these two areas of the animal, so to speak, of the physicality of the physical realm, we're told they must be on top of the altar. Both the vitality of the blood, the life force of the blood, the energy of the blood, and the laziness and the stasis of the fats, both of them should be atop the altar. When it comes to a sin, let's be lazy like the fat. And when it comes to a mitzvah, we should be eager and aggressive like the blood. This is a very interesting idea, and I think it's a very powerful insight and a very useful tidbit. Of course, you know, sacrifices, they're a distant, very, very distant idea from our perspective. We've never seen it. It sounds foreign to us. And even the whole idea of trying to go to a slaughterhouse and knowing what to take out and that also sounds very strange to us. But this concept, this insight can be a ground changing one, ground shifting one for us to realize that the only thing we need to change is the areas in which we deploy our excitement and our laziness. If we just change that and take both of them, so to speak, put them on top of the altar, that's it. It's just a magic formula. Be as lazy as you are right now, and be as eager and excited as you are right now. Just change the areas that you're excited for. And change the areas that you're lazy about. And that's it. That's all you need to do. There is a law that tells us, a halacha, that when you're about to get to, let's say, a shul, or about to get to a beis medrash, to a place of Torah study, you're supposed to run the last few steps to show your excitement to go there. I'm supposed to be one of the first 10 people there. And then when it's over, davening's over, let's say prayer is over, be one of the last 10 to leave. And, you know, our perspective is the opposite. The first 10,000 fans got this special limited edition bobblehead. Got to run to the game. When it comes to shul, it might get a little bit late. You know, you're only a half hour late. You know, it's still effectively the beginning. We could leave a little early. We could bolt a seconds over. If we just change the areas of our life that we're excited about, and we run to, and we're aggressive about, and we change the areas that we're lazy about, and we just dedicate the blood and the fats for God, that's all it takes. That's all it takes. Of course, it's easier said than done, but it's a nice perspective that would give us an understanding of this mitzvah. Now, the Sefer Chinuch, as he always does, gives us a little bit of a sprinkling, a sampling of some of the laws. The first thing it tells us is that this only applies to three animals, namely oxen, sheep, and goats. And he also notes that this is true, this law of the forbidden fats is true regardless if the animal is kosher or not. So suppose we have an animal that wasn't slaughtered, or wasn't slaughtered properly, or was slaughtered properly but was found to be non-kosher for some other reason, there would still be a distinction between the meat and the fats. Meaning that the severity of consumption of the forbidden fats would still have that heightened level of punishment of kares, whereas the meat itself would be prohibited, but not quite as severely. And he gets into a very fascinating law where there would be an animal whose fats would be permitted. And this is in itself just a fascinating law, and one that's going to make us all angry, because people get angry at these loopholes. Suppose there's a cow and the cow's pregnant. We don't view that fetus inside the cow as a separate living being. And this comes up when people have all the debates about abortion. This is one of the Talmudic citations that are featured. In the words of the Talmud, Ubar Yerech Imo, the fetus is like the thigh of the mother. It's just like a part of the mother. So when you slaughter a cow in the proper way, following all the laws, did you slaughter like the flank? Did you slaughter the ribs? Did you slaughter the back part of the animal or the front left foot of the animal? You slaughtered the animal, and the animal is viewed as like a single entity. And this animal is slaughtered, and therefore the leg, if you compare, you know, two legs, one of the animal that was slaughtered, one of the animals not slaughtered, they look the same. But because this was part of an animal that was slaughtered, this animal's kosher. And the other one was part of an animal that was not slaughtered, it's not kosher. But we view the animal as almost like one entity. And if the animal is kosher, then the entirety of the animal is kosher. Obviously, besides for the parts that are not permissible. But what happens when you slaughter an animal, animal's kosher, and you find a fetus inside the cow? That fetus, it's like the thigh of the animal. Meaning, it's considered part, at the time of the slaughtering, it was part of the animal, and thus it is slaughtered meat. It's like the leg. It's like the thigh. But what if, you know, the fetus was almost ready to be born? And you slaughter the animal, animal slaughtered, it's all kosher, and you pull out the baby. The baby's now running around. In the eyes of the law, that little thing that's running around is slaughtered meat. It's just, your steak is mobile, but it's just a steak. Because at the time of the slaughtering of the animal, of the cow, you slaughtered the animal and rendered all the meat inside that cow kosher. The fact that part of the meat from the cow has now become animated from, in some way that we don't even know how. I don't know how that this animal's running around or this little thing's running around. My steak is hard to pin down. But it is viewed as being kosher meat because it was, at the time of the slaughtering, was part of the animal. That was slaughtered. And now this is kosher beef. And you will be allowed, at least by Torah law, because there might be some rabbinic restrictions about this, you would be allowed to eat this cow without slaughtering it because it was slaughtered already. It was slaughtered already. It was slaughtered, and it is kosher. Oh, and for our purposes, the chelav, the forbidden fats, are not forbidden. Because this animal is not viewed as its own animal. It's just part of the mom. So the Sefer Chinuch gets into the whole discussion about the different cases, this very unusual circumstance where a cow is slaughtered and the fetus is, you find it alive, it is permissible to be consumed, and even the fats, because those are not fats of a cow. Those are fats of a piece of steak, and it's not part of the forbidden fats. It's part of the permissible fats. Which is very, very interesting. Now, a lot of details about that, so don't quote me on this, because there, you know, there are some other factors, but just the concept, and we're just trying to get, you know, look like a snapshot of some of the interesting parts of these laws. And this is a very, very large and fascinating subject of conversation regarding this mitzvah. What happens when you slaughter an animal in the proper way, rendering all the meat inside of it kosher? And then part of that meat is actually a fetus, which is alive. Well, no, it's not. But the eyes of the Torah, halakhically, is just viewed as a piece of kosher meat. And it would have ramifications for this law. The fats of that animal are actually not viewed halakhically as fats of an independent animal, and thus would be permissible under some circumstances. Now, the Sefer Chinuch, he does help us get a little bit of a sense of the laws. He categorizes the different parts of the animal that are part of these forbidden fats. He tells us that there's the fats on top of the innards, and the fats on top of the kidneys, and the fats on top of the flanks, and then there's other fats and membranes and blood vessels that would be rabbinically prohibited. And then he ends off with an interesting idea, and that is, how do we trust someone to say that they are, or that they have removed the fats? This is a separate question. You know, someone says, hey, here's a piece of meat. There ain't no fats there. And you don't know because you're not an expert. So he gives us a general rule, and that is that if someone is an expert and you have no reason to suspect that there's any sort of chicanery going on over here, they would be trusted. They would have a degree of trustworthiness that they, of course, could lose, but you as the consumer, if there's someone who has been trained and has been tested and has been vetted and has been credentialed as an expert, and you're a non-expert, you can trust them unless you have reason to not trust them. And this gets to a much larger conversation, is how do we know who we can trust when we are ignorant to the realities as they are. So we have to kind of outsource our trust. And what are the parameters of that? That too is a subject that relates to this law, as it does to many other laws. Mitzvah number 147. Very interesting. At least I found it interesting. The forbidden fats, a kosher animal that was processed in a kosher fashion. There are parts of it that may not be consumed and must be removed. And, only then may the meat that surround those areas be consumed. Mitzvah number 147, the forbidden fats. Of course, my email address is rabbiwolbe@gmail.com. It delights me when you reach out with questions, with comments, and with feedback.